to help capture notes on the whiteboards, to help facilitate the discussion, and go from there. Tom?
I'd like to start by suggesting a split in one of the categories, and it could be in any one of or a couple of those, but it's the issues of navigational and recreational access.
Okay.
Which are become, as more and more people use the bay, as the Mariposa operations are expanding within their leases,
mm-hmm.
it's becoming a significant issue on the bay.
So do you see that as a subset or a sub-bullet under site selection and access, that recreational access needs to be considered and
recreational addressed? And navigational access too.
Okay. You want me to write and then facilitate?
Other way around, it's working.
Okay.
And then, I'll leave it at that.
Under biosecurity, I'd like some consideration of the fact that all across the world, there's ample documented evidence that this species of oysters, the popular ones, as long as they have gone wild. It's become an invasive species. They're being removed right now from San Francisco Bay. So there is a potential solution for that, and that was recommended by the National Academy of Sciences in their study of the work in Drexostero, and that is to use triploids. So I would like that to be specifically addressed, whether that should be a best practice to use triploids to prevent. I mean, most of us in this room believe that the ocean is warming. Maybe some of us don't. But given that the ocean is warming and there's ample evidence of this happening, this is a potential that's growing out there, and I think we should get in front of it.
It's for, what is it for?
For biosecurity reasons, for limiting the risk of naturalization of Pacific oysters.
And there's tools?
Triploid oysters.
Triploids, yeah. Triploids.
For sure.
And then the second part of that is...
I'm sorry, we can't hear. What did you mention, an organism?
I'm sorry?
Did you mention an organism?
Yeah, the Japanese oysters have gone wild in many parts of the world. They've become an invasive species. They're considered invasive species in San Francisco Bay. There's money being spent to remove them from San Francisco Bay. The ocean's warming right now in Tamales Bay, generally speaking, too cold for them to procreate. But that's changing.
See.
And so I'm suggesting that in accordance with the recommendation from the National Academy of Sciences, that a best management practice should be to use triploids, which don't eliminate, but at least they decrease the risk that these...
Well, most of it does.
Yeah.
Sterile oyster seed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the second part is, again, about security, the approval of new species.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion is the department has been a little loose on that and has sometimes permitted new species to be cultivated that are non-native and are not in the habitat that you allow them to go in. And again, back to Drexostero, you folks allowed vanilla oysters to be grown there. And
clams. Vanilla clams, sorry.
Thank you. And there was no evidence of those ever being there, and that's an invasive species. So I'm not saying that manila clams should never be grown anywhere, but I would request under biosecurity that some documentation be done so that if you approve a non-native species in a given area, you show that it's already there, the risks of it going wild are limited, and so forth.
So maybe a theme from that might be analyzing risk from an invasive species introduction or an introduced species or something. But it's analyzing the risk, not necessarily declaring one way or the other, but taking that into consideration of an analysis.
Yeah, that's right. And I know you guys would introduce an invasive species, but not intentionally. But that's the concern, that the study should be done to make sure that minimize that risk.
I think we want to encourage folks to say, I hope that you're not asking us or waiting for us to respond. I think we want to listen and hear the point of view. I think there may be other other parts to those kinds of comments, but I'd rather just get folks talking.
Diane, next.
Just a suggestion, at some point in this process, it probably would be useful just in hearing the discussion thus far, that we need to define, and that could be a whole meeting in and of itself probably, defining non-native versus invasive, because they're very different things.
Thank you.
Richard?
Yes.
And then Richard?
Mine has to do with language. The slide that came before this said limitless. And to me, that language is very ambiguous. I think it should be, at least the group should consider something stronger, like strive to eliminate risk.
Okay, that's I think where we get to this second bullet point under considerations. What do we consider an acceptable level of impact? That's going to be a challenging question to answer, I believe. And so I'm not posing an answer to it, but I want everybody to think about it.
My comment was the very first one.
Right. No, I understand that. Yeah.
Okay.
Richard?
Dovetail on the other Richard's comment. I agree. I think stronger language should be there. I realize that that's an asymptotic function. We'll never get to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to see the goal, at least the spirit of the goal, say, well, let's get to the goal line. You might only get to the 30-yard line, but that looks a little more like it's got a built-in pump. That's one.
And I want everybody to recognize, this isn't language that's being proposed for the regulation. This is just something that I put up for us to consider today. Like, our goal today is to think about this as we are talking through these categories that we are trying to, I think, come to some level of decision-making today. Go ahead.
But my main point was, the thing that caught my ear in the first part of your slides was having the growers write their BMPs. That reminds me of the growers doing their self-assessed escrow cleanup cost estimate. So I would like to see that BMP be open for examination by people other than growers. Maybe people are on the pay a lot and see what things happen out there. So that it's not just a I will clean my room kind of please go to the baseball game.
That would be addressed by having a plan that is subject to the approval of the commission.
And it's open for public comment.
Exactly.
Okay. But I'm being...
Hi. I like the idea of buffers. I have a boat I use today, and I have a problem when I get close to these oceans. I don't want to run over. And sometimes they're very difficult to see. And they're not properly demarcated in the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to the boundaries of those oyster leases themselves. I understand by wandering around with my GPS, it was a shapefile that basically defines where those leases are.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if that file agrees with the meets and bounds descriptions of the oyster leases, because some of them seem to come way out to the center of the bay. So, and so that impacts the biodiversity element.
Right.
So there are requirements within our code that leaseholders get what's called an ace to private navigation from the Coast Guard. So all the leases should be clearly marked and delineated. There's different requirements for leases that are in the intertidal, where sticking stakes in the mud might be feasible, as opposed to leases that are always submerged where buoys would need to delineate the corners of a lease, but there are existing regulations already for that. And so we may be looking at the difference between adding it to a plan versus just simply looking at what we already know is required.
Yeah, just the converse of that is that I heard through the grapevine that one oyster grower to mitigate that problem was going to put out night lights along your oyster leases, and in smallest bay, we don't have a whole lot of light pollution, and that's how I would regard night lights on oyster leases.
I don't have all the answers on marking and navigation. I think that, like I say, the Coast Guard is a better set of expertise, and that's partly the reason why that requirement for that permit is handled by them. So I think in a different part of the state, there might be different considerations in terms of what's an appropriate marker device. Whether I don't know if it makes sense to put radar buoys up because, a typical boat user might not have a radar, so it might not be looking at that. So I think there's specifics in every region.
We have somebody in the back here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. if you're allowing the growers to come up with their own BMPs, you have to have some standards for what needs to be included.
Exactly.
And what, you can't have, you're going to address all of those things.
Well, this is just one option. This is what we're hopefully discussing today, is what standards need to be included in those plans. So these are four categories that I've come up with.
So, but there still could be, you're going to have some, within those, have some standards of the minimum that they have to meet, otherwise.
Yeah, that's when we get back to, this question is, what is the acceptable level of impact? What are the standards, the actual thresholds that these plans have to address? But before we can get to that, we have to come up with the categories, the topics that they have to address. And then within there, we kind of drill down into some of these subcategories of robust design, topic-centered discipline, and then we're going to drill down even further, I'm sure, to come up with what is the acceptable level. Gordon?
I'd like to go back to Tom's comment about buffers. Susan mentioned that the growers could go right out to the edge of the least wall-to-wall carpeting. But if that is actually the case, then what you're doing, because the edges of these beds need to be serviced, so you're going to have oyster boats outside the lees if you've got wall-to-wall carpeting inside the lees.
Put your hands on.
So
I'll call on you in just a second, so you don't have to pull your neck.
So I echo Tom's request for buffers along the perimeter of these leases. I look at the lease like a property where you build a house. You can't build your house right out to the edge of your property line. There are setbacks. So I think setbacks are important for navigational purposes, and they are important because they keep the operation of the oyster operation, including the servicing of the perimeter of the bag inside the leaf, and not put it outside.
Would we put that under sighting?
Could be under operations too, either way.
Okay.
Yep, Tony, you're next.
I think I have a relevant question in this context. In the roughly 10,000 acres that are in Tomales Bay, how many of them are under lease? This notion of wall to wall is just absolutely incorrect.
So I think there's about 500 under lease, and
yeah, it's like 5%.
30% of that is an actual aquaculture footprint.
Yeah, which gets you down to
2%.
Okay, I think it's really you've been talking about things in great generalities. All right. And some of them are correct, and some of them aren't correct, and some of them are valid points, and some of them aren't. But in this context, to describe, that this bay is covered with oyster farms wall to wall, I've heard the several ways of saying that, it's just absolutely incorrect. It's just not right.
It might be helpful, we've been planning to put together, I think Kirsten and we've been talking about putting together mapping and statistics associated with that, and they're validating some of the numbers that they have right now. I think that will help with the conversation going forward, not just here, but other places.
Representing aquaculturalists, we like to cooperate with our neighbors. And the first thing we like to see are facts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've talked a great deal about processes and about, ecological detriment. Okay. Oysters are, in fact, in this bay, the world's best source of protein with the smallest carbon footprint. while at the same time it does something directly good about the two largest environmental problems that we, well, the one environmental problem directly that we have, and that is ocean acidification. There, if you could assemble all the oyster shells that have been harvested from Tomales Bay in the last 110 years, it would be a mountain much, much bigger than this building. Mm-hmm. Several times the volume of this building, I'm quite certain. It performs a fundamentally good thing for the environment. Many of the things you're talking about, yes, they have validity, and sometimes farming gets sloppy, and as the intensity of coastline usage increases, sure, there are going to be some conflicts, but in the main, this is the best. You know, also mentioned global warming, and it is something that is being measured by the oysters in the bay today. The oysters in this bay are the best environmental canary that you could possibly ever have. I'll stop and not talk again. But I think there has to be some kind of frame of reference about what tremendous good oyster farming does. Mm-hmm. These are facts. And in the small extent of space that they use, I'm listening to things out of proportion. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I think in the back,
he's talking about that. This is what I gathered in the last 2 weeks.
Hold on a second. We're going to go you, and then look at me for a second.
This
you, then you, then you.
From oyster companies.
Okay,
in 17 days. From Promising Point to Marshall. You're talking about how good they are to the bay. This is what I'm picking up in 2 weeks. I only do from Thomas City Point to Marshall. I go there 3 times a week. So we have to address both sides of it. We've got to get serious about the plastic, you guys. I've lived here my whole life. This is terrible.
And let's be clear that not all debris in the bay is associated with aquaculture operations.
This
we
is
can
all
dump it on the ground. You can see
from
what
oyster bags
90%
parts of oyster bags.
90%.
Yeah, and I pay women dollar piece.
He does.
For every zip trash you picks up.
That's
if you're enforcing me on a regular basis. You're telling me, you're paid, and I really appreciate your effort. That's part of the effort.
Todd has been great. He, from day one, when I came to the farm, he stepped right up. The other oyster companies have not been so forthcoming.
So this brings up one of the categories.
Last comment up. Don't see any beaches to catch them for the whole day.
It is. It's
the northwest wind blows, everything comes down to Thomasini Beach. And so that's why it's rich. You know, Wynn walks her dogs, you know, several times a week, and she finds a lot of stuff. And I asked her to come with it.
Todd's been amazing.
And collect it up. So I just want to do that.
We had you next, and then you, and then we have one in the back, and then you're next.
I was just wondering if maybe a breakout of operational discipline
mm-hmm.
Would be education and training.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that gets at this topic that we're talking about in part, is education and training of staff that maintain materials so that they know that, you know, clipping zip ties and dropping them in the ocean is not acceptable. So as an example, you know, how do you train your workload, you know, the farming workload that's coming through and might be cycling through on a regular basis. So.
I agree. I think there's about 500, I've done the math on your files, about 530 acres at least out of maybe 10,000 acres. But I boat pretty much the entire bay. And sometimes it's super high tide, so I get like beyond the bay. And although it's not a wall-to-wall oyster lease, it's a wall-to-wall plastic problem. I find plastic everywhere. And so that's one point. Two, you kind of got on people talking in loosey-goosey terms and not getting any facts. And then you talked about a building-sized pile of oysters and that oysters are the best canary in the world. So what's good for the bees is good for the game.
Back.
Sure. So I know that the Fish and Game Commission does not have the same jurisdiction over the Humboldt Bay aquaculture projects that are currently being evaluated, specifically the Coast Seafood Project. But I would just suggest, when it comes to developing DMPs, to ensure that some of the really new evolving discussions around managing existing impacts and evaluating future expansion plans from the North, the Humboldt Bay example be incorporated into this conversation. And we will tell the benefits of the commission in dealing with them to be lost or not incorporated. So a couple things that come to my mind is there's some really important conversations going on around evaluating cumulative impacts, evaluating the carrying capacity of that particular body of water, and then analyzing sort of user impacts. So when you're looking at navigational issues, recreational use, traditional cultural use, doing some sort of comprehensive planning to evaluate how all of those district users can cooperate. So I hope there can be coordination.
I think it was Karen, and then Marcelo, and then Tony.
In terms of maps, I just wanted to point out, so I work for the Greater Grand Lawn Sanctuary, and we're one of the lead agencies for the Tuolumne Bay Mooring Program, and for part of that program, we developed a multi-layer map that's on our website that does have all the aquaculture lease areas, not where there's active,
yeah.
So it's the whole area. But you can click on and click off that data layer, as well as many others, including where the mooring zones are, where the moorings are. It's actually being updated right now this week, so there'll be a new copy up there starting next week. But it runs on Adobe PDF. You don't need anything special. The one that's downloaded and free, and you just turn it on, and you can click layers like you're in a GIS kind of system. And so the information is out there. And then I just wanted to speak a little bit about the maintenance of environmental quality. In terms of habitats, water quality, and species, I think what's really important is when you're looking at habitats that you define specifically sensitive habitats, for example, that have been designated as essential fish habitat or areas of special biological significance or anything that's specific. In terms of water quality, I know that the California Department of Public Health does a lot of analysis on, when there's activities and recreation and how aquaculture and recreation have to buffer against each other. So I think you have information there, especially for small bay. And in terms of species, looking at keystone species, anything that's endangered or threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you just drill down a little bit on those three things, you'll find that there's some things in small bay in particular that you need to take a closer look at, such as eelgrass.
So I have sensitive species, special status species, and I think the other was keystone.
Everyone has a certain name for it,
but you said
ESA listed.
Okay.
Species.
Right, so I'm calling those special status species. They have a designation either as endangered, threatened, or they're protected under another law, federal law.
Yeah, like brown fish essential fish habitat.
One of the things that we're going to grapple with in this process and discussions, and I don't want to knock it or hamper it in any way, but there, when it comes to citing new lease applications, there's a CEQA process, there's a NEPA process, all involved with evaluating these kinds of impacts for a new operation, or for changes to an existing operation that are significant. So what we're trying to get at has more to do with day-to-day, week-to-week operations or management practices of a given facility, as opposed to, I think we want to hear these concerns. We may put them in the parking lot for other discussions, and you may not hear us come back to it within the context of BMPs. Some of them are practices, some of them have more to do with our management as an agency or various agencies over the activity in general and where it's allowed.
So I guess I'm headed for the parking lot with this comment. But it falls perfectly from what the NOAA woman just said. Zoning is a practice widely used by local governments to prevent death in the land use area from landowner interaction. And it's also used by the federal agencies. We have national parks, wilderness areas, et cetera, down the line to the multiple use designations like national forest. And they're starting to use zoning too. They're starting to get smarter. So this, I guess, doesn't plug into the BMP level of this, in this process. But at the front end, an outsider like myself that knows little about biology or aquaculture would feel a lot about regulation of air quality, water quality, land use, species, and so on. Could feel a lot better about this if I went on, clicked on the website, and said the aquaculture plan for Tomales Bay, and had a map, and it said, here's the no-no areas, the eelgrass, the mouths of the creeks where the manure comes down from the ranches and the nitrates and so on, and over here's the swimming areas, and here's the place the boaters all get in and out of the bay, which in this bay happens to be a narrow place down the west side of the bay. I feel a lot better. I feel like this wasn't just a reflexive government regulatory process where the private sector businesses come in with their plans and we narrow information base say, well, I guess that's okay. I feel a lot better about it if there was some forward planning on the part of the government agency that said these are good areas, these are bad areas, and all the rest we don't know. Right? At least the triage level of zoning in the bay. And that's kind of what this woman is saying here about field grass. And then the second thing I want to say, and this again comes from my broad practice in other regulatory arenas in California, is this process is oddly similar to the SB 375 process of all the regions have to do sustainable community scenarios. And that was a process that was left to each region to do their own greenhouse gas reduction through transportation and land use planning. A very difficult charge, since different agencies do land use and transportation. And so what they did is they let each region do their plan. They didn't give them much in the way of guidelines. And they did. And then they got reviewed by the Air Board, and they're in their second or third rounds now, but they have to redo them every three or four, I forget which years. So they're on a standardized and fairly frequent cycle. And under those circumstances, it was good to let them, if I may now use this terminology, each operator do their own BMPs, and then we see them come by every few years, and we might let them start with what they want to do, right? And then the interest groups might come back and say, no, and other parts of California or the country, these other things work, and then we can argue about all that. And then we see this as a process of approximation over time to where we get some balance between too much and too little regulation. But what I see here is what's typically called a reflexive or responsive, meaning not active but passive, government regulatory effort. In your case, you don't have the staff to do otherwise, I suspect, and your statutes probably tell you to do it this way. So if you view this in the long haul, letting the operators submit BMPs and then we can all comment on them, but you know, you mainly kind of go with what they suggest, I think that's a good way to get buy-in from the operators personally. And we can, by measuring what's going on in the bay, see whether they work or not. But we do need to spend time, I think, today talking about what are the outcome things we're going to measure.
I think you bring up some really good points, and I just want to...
Water quality and species,
yep,
and so on.
What you were kind of going dancing around, not intentionally, but when you're talking about zoning and planning and layout, the term is called marine spatial planning. There are various examples of attempts to do that around the country and around the world. It's a very expensive and involved process, as you might imagine. But it's also one where you need a crystal ball to know what might happen in the future. And so there's folks on both sides of that that are strong proponents of doing that so that people have some certainty. And there are folks that have some reservations because it's hard to predict, and it's hard to devote the right amount of resources to do it smartly.
Well, that's what said triage. There are some yes areas, some no areas, and perhaps most of the bay would be maybe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You show us in your application.
Sure.
Tony has been waiting very patiently.
I just wanted to say, I was heartened by hearing the feedback there to my my positive description of oyster culture. And it seems to me, we've been reading, and this has been an issue within our board meetings and everything else. We do discuss it, and we think, and we talk about what might be done. But from what my I don't know, it's not that limited a background. It's been going on for years. I can hear that a huge amount of the problem that requires practices is about solid waste management.
Mm.
And to me, that gives me great joy, because that's something we can solve. It probably begins to a certain extent, everybody's pointing out that it doesn't all come from the aquaculture industry, and there's only so much we can do. But if there is an operational discipline, which is one of the things on Kirsten's laundry list there, that goes a long, long way to solving perhaps the majority of the questions from the community. And we're all for that. We've even talked about buying a pickup trash sign that this area is policed by the California Aquaculture Association. We've even talked about such things. And that's part of it, but we can only go so far, and only so much of it is actually directly related to us. So we hope to cooperate.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear it. Gordon?
I want to go back to buffers again. Karen mentioned eelgrass, and I believe it's under your current regulations, you can't put oysters on top of eelgrass. Which is a good first step, but the problem is that of course the sun comes at an angle, and so consequently the shade that gets cast is not exactly on the footprint of the eelgrass, and secondly eelgrass ebbs and flows in its spatial use, and if you're in a situation where the grower is allowed to put bags every time the eelgrass recedes, the bags go forward, you're going to have a ratcheting effect where there'll eventually be no eelgrass. So I think it's really important to have a buffer around eelgrass beds that allow for some ebb and flow and some adaptive management. If the eelgrass starts moving forward, that the bags have to be trimmed back to allow it to. But eelgrass is really important.
What happens when there's not eelgrass and oyster culture is started and eelgrass then comes? I'm not trying to make a point. I'm just... It's two things, and
I
we grapple with that all the time.
It is a problem, and I don't propose a solution. Growing oysters to my friends in the aquaculture community is really important. I support it. I just want to make sure it's done with the minimum possible impact to things like eelgrass.
Yes.
I think it was Diane, and then Louise, and then...
So I wanted to make a suggestion because I've heard some really informative comments. I'm hearing a lot of themes pop out. I'm hearing recommendations to look at Humboldt Bay as a model, looking at cumulative effects, carrying capacity, user impacts. These things are all being examined in Humboldt Bay under CEQA and under the permitting process with the Corps of Engineers permit and the Coastal Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, some other points that were raised in the Greater Farallons, including sensitive habitats, essential fish habitat, water quality, and addressing ESA species, those are also part of the regulatory permitting process.
Mm-hmm.
So I would caution, in order to make the best management practices effort worthwhile and efficient, to not be redundant, to not reinvent the wheel, but that the BMPs absolutely should align with other permitting processes and permitting requirements, because those processes do drill in very deeply into all of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the other piece that stood out to me was that I think the outreach and education that Eric, I think you raised that point about educating the growers. I also think an educational outreach piece to help the general public better understand what a shellfish operation actually looks like, what it consists of. And there are different, as you know, there are different types of shellfish culturing done in different geographic areas, and the methods used in Tomales Bay are not necessarily the same as used in Humboldt Bay. So better understanding about those practices, I think, would help build that relationship in terms of the community, whether it's Tomales Bay or Humboldt Bay or wherever it may be,
mm-hmm.
that you have a better understanding on both sides of that fence. And
mm-hmm.
certainly, I'm happy to contribute to that. My last point was regarding marine spatial planning and talking about siting, and that's become really a cornerstone for planning and anticipating aquaculture development in Southern California, which is basically offshore.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can imagine, the different user conflicts that arise in the offshore environment
mm-hmm.
are just orders of magnitude greater than they are in a small bay. And so it is a tool that it isn't the end all, but it is a tool that can greatly inform these kinds of exercises.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of growing interest both in academia and the scientific community, and within NOAA, we're investing a lot of resources in marine spatial planning. And so consider us a resource that we may be able to help with some of these efforts, but it is a really good tool. But it is a tool, it's not the total answer.
A couple of things. I do want to, I recognize that the commission, Fish and Game Commission, got a request to have it initiate or pursue a marine spatial planning effort for Tomales. Number one, it's not just a Fish and Game Commission. That's a much broader conversation than just how are we going to use this for aquaculture. And the commission is not the right one to do such a thing. Just so the commission has already said that we wouldn't be the appropriate lead for that. Number two, it's very expensive. And number three, in lieu of that, let's have a conversation at least to start understanding what information the public believes is necessary to consider if it is going to consider any new lease areas. One last point is there's a hanging shadow of changing ocean conditions associated with whether you think it's from a climate change or just observed patterns in the ocean that requires adaptability. So having permanent footprints for everything may or may not protect the habitats you think, because the habitats might shift over to another area. And we want to always recognize the necessity for adaptive management for all of our uses. But thank you for that.
One last point just to add in that I'm sure you've already thought of it, but for the good of the group, NOAA Fisheries does have a California eelgrass mitigation policy, which is utilized in the permitting process, and it addresses things like areas that are void of eelgrass currently, if eelgrass moves into an area later, when the best time is to survey, approach mitigation, comprehensive planning is widely encouraged. So certainly that would be a tool that I think would be responsive to a lot of the concerns expressed in the room today, but also might be really helpful for the DMPs.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Okay. I just want to say, as a concerned citizen, I'm interested in the cautionary principle for the environmental community. And this business of allowing a company to kind of bring a plan and then have a kind of trial and error kind of approach to solving possible problems is absolutely goes against the environmental community's cautionary principle, which the CEQA and the NEPA would be helpful in. It's surprising to me that in the beginning of this conference you talked about 1907 was the date that the laws started coming into effect for the oysters, and I'm going, wow, I mean, we're still talking about trial and error. I mean, what's going on with that?
So the
and by the way, there's cattle grazing on Walker Creek within the riparian setback. You know, and I went down and reported it, and it's still happening. Like, oh yeah, well, we'll just do that in the summer. That doesn't make any sense either for the oysters. And the other issue, one more, and that is putting up a sign saying pick up litter. I think maybe the people that are creating the plastic should be picking up the litter, not the concerned citizen.
I'm not sure you, just to clarify what was suggested, that was about one of those roadsides where someone has adopted an area and the grower and California Shellfish Growing Association in that case was talking about they, you know, they've even entertained adopting, doing kind of an adopt an area for litter pickup, which is
well,
taking responsibility not only for their own, but for others as well.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Ashley?
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate in terms of the level of impact, I think it does make a lot of sense to aim for, you know, a higher standard of you know, zero or minimal impact. And then with that being said, I understand that it's, you know, that's probably not something that's possible, you know, tomorrow or maybe not right away. But then thinking of and in terms of benchmarks and a timeline, and I think the other main point I'd like to make is about...
Are you talking about the, like, environmental quality side of things or...
I think BMPs in general, our general.
Like in general, like when Kirsten had mentioned, like, you know, what getting to the goals, what are our goals about this?
Uh-huh.
I'm saying kind of we want to reiterate the point, we want to aim high, let's have a goal of very minimal environmental impact, since there's already so many other environmental impacts, but then, and then also the point of how do we get there. So thinking about, I think, you know, looking at these categories makes a lot of sense, and then as I feel like we also need sort of an overarching, each one of these plans, you know, shall contain measurable and enforceable standards, or kind of how do we get to having some measurable standards, like, you know, in the water quality world, sometimes that's numerics, maybe it's, I know many of the growers already document how much marine debris they're collecting, so we can look at that and see, you know, what are we approving, or, you know, is there still room for improvement, and then in terms of enforceability, making sure that the plans include some provisions for site inspections and patrolling and monitoring so that we can, you know, kind of get to where we're going, get to this goal.
Mm-hmm.